You're listening to Speaking of Music, a show by and about musicians. I'm Barry Livingston. Today, our in-studio guest is saxophonist, keyboardist, vocalist, and educator Scott Nielsen. I've known Scott for decades, and he is one of the most well-respected and well-rounded members of the Hamilton music community, with an amazing ability to fit into many diverse musical settings. Scott joined the Musicians Union and started playing professional gigs when he was 16 years old. During his 20s, he played with the Swingin' Johnsons, a blues R&B band, and then around 1998 began working at the Reservoir Lounge in Toronto with different singers, including Jake Chisholm, Janice Hagen, and Tyler Urima. Scott also toured the West with guitarist and trumpeter Jeff Healy and singer Alex Pangman, and is presently leading a new project called Groove Miller, playing Hammond organ and covering vocals. As an instructor, Scott has worked with students of the Hamilton All-Star Jazz Band for over 30 years and has also taught at Mohawk College, Hillfield Strathallan College, and at his own studio, West End Music. Oh, and did I mention that he is also a great car mechanic? Welcome to the show, Scott.
How you doing, Barry?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it's really great to have you here. And to begin, I'd like to go back quite a bit to when you were growing up, and if you can you recall any of your earliest musical memories, and possibly what drew you to playing in the first place?
Yeah, I can actually. And coincidentally, it connects you and I because it occurred on Salt Spring Island. And Barry and I met on Salt Spring Island going back quite a few years. And I had a family member who lived out there, and we went out for a holiday when I was, I think, around 8 years old. And the newest album at that time was Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. And we were listening to that, and I was looking over the ocean and hearing this great album, and there was a saxophone solo, and I was like, what the heck is that? That sounds pretty cool. And that was probably the first thing I heard that I identified as saxophone and said, yeah, I want to play that. That would be, what would that be, Barry? 1974, 75?
If somebody, yeah.
Somebody could look up the Dark Side of the Moon and see when that came out.
Did you receive any music lessons when you were young before you started to play sax, like any piano lessons or anything?
Yeah, I did a little bit, a few years of piano when I was very young. Didn't really amount to too much, but had a good time doing it.
Well, I don't know about that. You're playing pretty good organ now.
Trying my best.
When did you actually start playing saxophone? Was it around that time, or did you have to wait till you got into high school for that?
So it was about grade four, and actually I grew up in Burlington, so I contacted the Burlington Teen Tour Band, or my parents did, and I met with one of the guys there. I think in those days, if I remember correctly, his name was Don Wright, and sat down with him, and he said, well, you're pretty short, and so he said, the saxophone's too big for you, which I think was a bit of a ploy, because in those days, essentially everybody started on clarinet. They wanted to delay the saxophone, so I started on clarinet, and I probably played that for 2 or 3 years. Eventually had to threaten my parents that I would quit music if I didn't get switched over to saxophone, so I think that was around grade eight I switched to saxophone.
Do you feel you advanced pretty quickly once you started to play the saxophone?
Not particularly. well, you know, maybe in comparison to a regular grade eight music class, yes, it was. I sensed that I maybe had some potential in comparison to the the majority, but nothing extremely exceptional at that point, that's for sure.
It's interesting because I remember the kind of books we played. I played trumpet in middle school and okay. through high school. I remember the kind of books we had at the beginning, like Easy Steps to the Band. And then I compare that to our counterparts in the United States that maybe started when they were, you know, 9, 10 years old and were already like far more advanced by the time they reached that point in high school. It's kind of interesting, the two different countries.
Yeah, I agree completely. And, you know, you've probably talked to more American musicians than I have, but having talked to a few, I've been able to sort of confirm that too, that, they start young and work hard all the way through.
When you were in high school, was your music teacher Russ Wheel who started the Hamilton All-Star Jazz Band?
No, he wasn't, because Russ, who we'll probably get around to talking about, he was in Hamilton, I was in Burlington.
Oh, right.
And actually, because I was more involved in actually playing in a band that was playing clubs and whatnot, I actually didn't take music till I was in my last year of high school.
And you, I know, started playing professionally, and I'm wondering how you made that transition. You joined the union. Did you just got asked to play in a band, or did you approach them? Or
yeah, well, actually, a friend of mine came to me and said, I know a bunch of guys are putting a band together. Didn't I see you once with a saxophone? And I said, yeah, that might have happened. And so we put this band together. We were playing ska music. There was a ska revival in the early 80s. And so we were covering all the British ska music and some Jamaican ska. And that's kind of where I started. And then we actually won a few local competitions. And then we found a booking agent. And then this booking agent said, well, look, you guys, I've got you in the Alma Combo. Which at those times, well, and in those days, there was an upstairs and a downstairs. Of course, the upstairs was where all the illustrious bands came. And they put us down on the ground floor. And in those days, it was what they called a union band or a union bar, which not everybody is aware of what that is today. But it was a union bar. So you had to be a member of the union, the musicians union, to play there. So that's why I joined.
Interesting. So that means you got paid scale, and I imagine you played in Hamilton as well with that band? Or?
Yeah, we did. We played all around the area here. Actually, we played at McMaster, where we are today, a bunch of times and during, you know, in the day. This would be mid-80s, yeah.
What was that first experience like playing professionally for you? Did it feel comfortable? Did it feel a bit, you know, were you nervous at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, maybe the first time it felt a little bit awkward, being a person who, you know, I wasn't really in drama or anything, like I didn't have a theater background or anything like that. So the first time stepping on stage was maybe a little awkward. But, you know, by the time I got to the Alma Combo, I'd probably had a handful of gigs under my belt, and it felt pretty normal. I realized that it was sort of what I wanted to continue doing for hopefully the rest of my life. At that time, that's what I thought anyway.
What were some of the things that you learned on those first gigs as a practicing professional or performer?
Wow, that's a really good question. Showing up on time, obviously, is one of them. Also, I probably up to that point as a young kid thought, you know, I didn't really realize at that stage of the game that music was about the audience per se, and that you know, it's actually a business. I mean, it was prior to that, it was so much just fun for me to play music with all my friends, and then suddenly it's like, okay, you're thrust in this world where it's like you start to realize there's a business to this, and you have to, you know, keep everyone happy, I guess you would say.
Did you immediately go into attending the Mohawk program, or did you take any time off between high school and going into college?
Yeah, high school was a really long, drawn out arrangement for me. I think I graduated with a grade 12 in those days, and but I was there somewhere around 5 years to accomplish that. But so I had about a year off, and decided that if I wanted to do anything more than ever just play in a ska band, which I loved playing in that band at the time, but I realized that there was more sophisticated music out there, essentially jazz, that I wanted to get into. So maybe a year off, and then I went to Mohawk College, actually, still in Hamilton here.
Right. I remember at the Mohawk program, there definitely was a jazz emphasis, but it was actually pretty diverse. There were people, I remember when I was there, playing classical music, playing country music, and but the education was more kind of classical and jazz courses, I remember.
Yeah, absolutely. And that part of it I thought was amazing. I was just explaining to a student the other day about counterpoint, which I'm sure you know about. We probably shared the same teacher there who
Nick
taught
Deutsch.
It. Nick Deutsch, yeah, yeah. And yeah, I love that fact. And also it was probably a first introduction to me just to precisely what you said, all those different types of music. And yeah, it was a great environment to be in.
Are there things that, again, it's kind of a similar question to a few minutes ago, but things that you learned in that program that you still take with you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in those days, I think, although I started doing what, you know, I guess you would call sideman work today, or then you called sideman work. I started doing that when I was in school. I don't think you could get that education at that time. There wasn't enough sort of, well, there was a lot of live music still going on, but not as much as, say, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where you could get that education without being in school. Or it was more difficult, for sure.
I'm Barry Livingston. You're listening to Speaking of Music, and our guest today is Scott Nielsen, local saxophonist and keyboardist, educator, and vocalist. There was a band you joined called the Groovin' Johnsons.
Swingin' Johnsons.
Swingin' Johnsons.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm mixing up metaphors here.
That's okay.
So how did that come about?
That was interesting. I remember the connection. Of course, everybody knows Alonga McQuaid in this country. And so there was a well-known guy. In those days, it wasn't Alonga McQuaid, it was a store called Lakeshore Music in Burlington, and everybody went there if they had to get any kind of real musical equipment. And there was, Norm Thornton, people will know his name, and I came in one day and he said, oh, some guys came in the other day, they were looking for a saxophone player, I gave your name. And yeah, it began an eight-year relationship, so I have Norm to thank for that. And yeah, they were an interesting blend of players, you know. They appreciated the influence I brought, which was maybe some jazz training, I don't know how I would describe it. Like they were playing barroom music. Let's put it that way. So I quickly had another education in, you know, how important it is to, again, you know, be the, like, it's just a, I don't want to say, keep saying a business, because there is an art to it. But at the same time, there is the responsibility to the crowd, to the audience, and to have people enjoy what you're doing, you know?
Mm-hmm. And to some extent, you might have been playing for dancers as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was a big part of that band. And you know, we sort of enjoyed getting into a place and then seeing the dance floor full within 20 minutes, half an hour. You know, that was always a sign that we were in, so to speak, you know.
The owner loves that kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
At a certain point, you got into a really long-standing gig, which is still going today at the Reservoir Lounge in Toronto. How did you make the connection to start doing that?
Well, that's, again, I keep saying an interesting question, but it is an interesting one. So the Swingin' Johnsons, who we were just talking about, occasionally I would have nights where I couldn't play with them, and to just further the Hamilton connection, I would always ask my friend Chris Gale, who, interestingly, his father was a radio announcer, and not in Hamilton, I think in Toronto. But anyway, Chris was a good friend of mine and a younger saxophone player at that time, and so he would fill in for me. And so I took a short sojourn out to the West Coast, where I met you, on Salt Spring Island. And when I came back, of course, I had no work. As every musician knows, when you move away, everything dries up. So I got back, and it was Chris Gale who called me and said, I remember what he said. He said basically something like, do you want to work 7 nights a week? And I said, yes. and he wasn't wrong. It was right around the time I think everybody remembers that sort of swing revival, largely started by a Gap commercial, if I remember correctly, in the late 90s. And that's when all the swing dance revival happened. And so if you could play, you know, any of those old swing tunes that everybody wanted to hear, then you were working a lot.
How did you hook up with guitarist and trumpet player Jeff Healy? And there is a radio connection there, because when I was at CIUT doing my show on Wednesday, Jeff did his show on Thursday, and he did everything for himself. He had no one helping him. It was amazing.
You know, anybody who spent any time with him knows that blindness wasn't much of a detriment for him. He could pull off anything. I could spend 20 minutes talking about the things I saw him do that I would have thought were impossible before I met him. But yeah, I met him through the Reservoir Lounge. You know, I think he came in one night and, as I recall, I think I was going through a bit of a phase where I was trying to imitate sort of the simplicity of some Lester Young solos and, or, you know, maybe that was just what was happening. But he kind of commented on that, which I thought, geez, I guess I was playing the right thing at the right time. And I think that got me in his band at that. Well, it was actually Alex Pangman's band.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. But he was scouting around, I guess.
Oh. Well, here's a plug for Alex. I'm friends with her, and I love her show on Jazz FM.
She's a great lady. I love Alex.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And she knows a lot about the music, too.
Yes.
How did your private teaching practice get started? I know you've been teaching at Mohawk and teaching some of the students in the Hamilton All-Star Jazz Band as well.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Russ Wheel earlier, and I guess this will be a little bit of a plug to his organization in Hamilton here, the All-Star organization. And so I think when I got back to Hamilton and Chris Gill was the person who got me playing again. And then I gave Russ Wheel a call and said, hey, I'm back in town and I'm, you know, love to be teaching some students. And I can say he was almost single-handedly responsible for quite a number of students that came for probably 20 years. I mean, still to this day, it's my connection with Russ that sort of set that all into motion.
Amazing. He was my grade 13 teacher, as
okay.
You know, and we were, I don't know how true this is, but I like to say that we were the kind of the seed, we planted the seed that year, which is 1982 to 83. And, you know, from there, I think he got inspired to like, hey, let's keep doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's neat. So, yeah. So Russ has played a big part in both our lives. Yeah.
That's great.
I'm still at this point, he's still writing, writing arrangements for a project I'm working on with him right now. A tribute act, I guess you could call it a tribute act of, the early, I guess it's called the Legendary Ladies. It includes Tina Turner and, Whitney Houston, and you know, we cover a lot of music of those genres. There's four singers, and yeah, it's great. And so it's great working with Russ again, and first time I've ever worked with him in a musical situation.
Amazing. Yeah. Is he playing bass in that and singing?
No, he's playing keyboards.
Okay.
And not much singing because we've got these four great female vocalists, and the connection continues.
Are there any the main things that you consistently emphasize to students when you're teaching them?
I guess that depends on what they're headed toward. And since so many of my students are, you know, interested in those groups, the first thing I talk about is always just the ability to read, which for any horn player, saxophone, trumpet, whatever, you know, you got to be able to read. I'm sure you know that as a piano player. So I probably start with reading, and then, you know, eventually there's so many things to cover. Tone is huge. But probably reading would be the first thing, just which is not really my forte or wasn't my forte. But, you know, they always say if you struggle with something, it's easier for that person to teach it because they. Yeah. So I feel OK teaching it. But that would be the first thing, probably. Yeah.
Can you tell me about your newest project, Groove Miller, where you're playing organ, actually,
yeah.
And singing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say I've had a lifelong love of the Hammond B3 specifically. And was actually lucky enough. I still don't have a B3, but I have an R3, which is sort of I think it's like a church model of the B, same internals. But that love goes back to, you know, you probably remember as well as I do when we were kids. I mean, you could still walk into a mall and see an organ store. And so I've always loved the sound of it. And so anyway, during COVID, when things kind of shut down for most of us musicians, I thought, well, I'm going to spend some time on this thing and see if I can not figure out how to play it a little better than I was playing it before COVID. So I just started, and I've always had a love of singing and essentially, you know, groove music in general, which is everything from, you know, what some people would call soul or funk to R&B to some jazz too. And I just started working away at a repertoire, chopping away at it. And I think when I was up to 30, 40 songs, I went, geez, I could actually get out and play some Hammond in public, which was... you know, a little scary the first couple times. There's a lot of buttons to push and a lot of bars to pull, but it worked out, and I'm having a blast doing it now.
Wow, congratulations. It really does seem amazing. It's juggling a lot of balls plus the vocals at the same time. I don't know how you do it.
It's different. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah. Just to wrap up, do you have any, I know this is a really big topic, but do you have any thoughts about music education, where it is right now, and perhaps where it's heading?
Well, I don't want to use that same line about, that's a really interesting question, but that's probably the most interesting question you've asked today, because Hamilton has gone through, you know, do you want me to talk a little bit about what's happened in Hamilton of late, or?
It's up to you.
Yeah. So the music programs, what I would describe as both the post-secondary music programs in Hamilton are no longer functioning. So I actually have one remaining student. I actually teach at MAC here, at McMaster. And I think when he's done next year, that'll be the end of, you know, you won't be able to take saxophone here, I guess, anymore, or any of those band instruments. I know there is some sort of skeleton program being continued, but I don't really know specifics, so I shouldn't say. But Mohawk too, you would know better than I, but I think that program started when? 1976?
Yeah.
Something
like
that.
Yeah, around that time, yeah.
And yeah, it's next year will be the official last year of that program. So I can't really say where it's heading, but it's certainly heading for change. Let's put it that way, because, even the Toronto programs, I know U of T is still strong, I hear. Humber, it's hard to say. I don't know. It's a really good question, Barry.
Well, Scott, I've really enjoyed talking with you today. The time has just flown by.
Yeah, you too. It's been great.
Before we go, can you just mention a quick word or two about the music we're going to be listening to in the interview here?
Yeah, sure. Just to sort of provide some variety, I brought a song, Joe Beam tune, actually, called Photographia, which I recorded with an old friend of mine named Mark Ucci, who still plays around Hamilton. And it's just the two of us playing, just a short little version of that beautiful tune. And the second one is actually a tune called If You Want Me to Stay, which is sort of I guess you would call it an R&B or soul classic. And that one I'm playing the organ on.
We hope you've enjoyed today's interview today with Scott Nelson on Speaking of Music. For more information on Scott and his music, please visit the website www.groovemiller.ca. I'm Barry Livingston. Thanks for listening.
Hey, students. Have you stumbled in your course and want a fresh start? Well, Athabasca University has your back. AU offers more than 850 courses that align to your program, so you can retake your course online, turn that grade around, improve your GPA, explore new subjects, and study from anywhere. Visit athabascau.ca to browse our online courses and transform your education today.
Support local independent media and get great deals with a Friends of CFMU card. For only $30, you get discounts and bargains all across the Hamilton area at various businesses. All you have to do is donate a minimum of $30 to 93.3 CFMU. For more information, just go to cfmu.ca and click on Friends of CFMU in the footer.
Friends are what we use every day. Most of the time we use it in the wrong way.
Support CFMU and get great deals too. Use the card at the James Street Bookseller, Moody's, Picks and Sticks, Relay Coffee Roasters, and Revolution Records.
And they treat you real cool, and some mistake your kindness for being the fool. We like to be with
Radio Without Borders.
Radio is something for everyone.
93.3 CFMU. Radio with a personality.
Cold.